Now here's a question I was given at the end of the last hour that I think is very important. It is, the question was this. Dr. McRae, why do you call the fourth king Xerxes first when verse 1 talks about Darius? And then verse 2 says, now I will show you the truth, there shall stand yet three kings and the fourth. It seems that the fourth would point to further kings away from Darius and not the king next, Xerxes, first. Now this is a very important question because there is a matter that I have mentioned but not stressed that if you don't have clearly in mind could easily cause you confusion. You might say there are two elements enter into that. The first is, as we have noticed, chapters 10 to 12 form a sort of a unit. And of those three chapters, the first verse in chapter 11 belongs with what precedes rather than what follows. But the second point is this, that this Darius the Mede is a different person from Darius the king of Persia. Darius the Mede seems to have been the man whom Cyrus put in charge of the kingdom of Babylon after he conquered it. Most people think, most interpreters think, it was a man named Gobryas who is mentioned in one of Cyrus's inscriptions. One recent writer thinks it's another name for Cyrus himself. But this Darius the Mede is different from the Persian king Darius, who was mentioned on the sheet of facts of ancient history that I gave to you. So it is very good to have that clearly in mind, and I appreciated greatly having this question. Now the papers that the answers to the test that I gave you 2 weeks ago, I wasn't able to discuss last week because I was away quite a bit of the time between the test and our meeting last week. But now they have been carefully gone over. Some of them are very good and some of them are quite disappointing. And I believe that it would be helpful to take the time to look at these questions, to take a few minutes and look at the different questions together. I think I'll start with the questions that were given to people with odd-numbered seats. The first of those was briefly state the critical theory regarding the meaning of Daniel's predictions. And this can be briefly stated in about two sentences, but it is quite important at various points of our interpretation. Our purpose in this class is not to discuss the critical theory. We believe that this is a book that God inspired. The critical theory is that it was not written by Daniel, but two centuries later. We could spend a good deal of time on the evidences. I believe that the evidences are not sufficient to raise great doubt about Daniel having written it. But there are many commentaries written from that viewpoint, and it affects their interpretation at many points. So it is vital that we have a clear understanding what the critical theory is. And the critical theory, which was advanced as early, at least, as the 2nd century A.D., and which was answered by St. Jerome in the 4th century A.D., the critical theory is that the book of Daniel was written at about 160 B.C., that it was written in order to encourage the Jews at the time when Antiochus Epiphanes, a Seleucid king, was persecuting them. And that it claims to be written by a man three centuries earlier and predicts things which the writer knew had already happened. And so he gives past history as if it was future prediction. And that when it comes to Antiochus Epiphanes, it gives a true account of him and his reign up to a certain point. And then beyond that, it just gives the guesses of the writer and the hopes, his hopes as to what might occur. Now, this affects a great many commentaries on the book of Daniel. And, for instance, F.W. Farrar, whose Life of Christ is very highly regarded by many, has written a commentary on Daniel, which is written from this critical viewpoint, that the book was written in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. And so it should not take long to briefly state the theory, but it is very important to have it in mind. Then the second question was, discuss the meaning of the words, thou art this head of gold. There were a few students who gave some interesting words about the importance of gold and the high, great importance of Nebuchadnezzar and that sort of thing, which is rather obvious, but not what we discussed in class under the discussion of this verse. I pointed out at that time, as shown on the sheets of facts of ancient history I gave you, that Nebuchadnezzar was succeeded by Amel-Marduk, who was succeeded by Nergal-Sharezer, who was succeeded by Labashi-Marduk, who was succeeded by Nabonidus. And so if the head of gold means Nebuchadnezzar himself personally, then there are three kings after him before the next kingdom comes. You can't say this next kingdom is his son who reigned only about 3 months, and the third kingdom, the next king who reigned for 4 years, and then the fourth kingdom, his son who reigned about 3 months. That, of course, would be absurd. So it is clear that either there is a break between Nebuchadnezzar, an unmentioned interval between him and the second kingdom, which it says will come after thee, or, as I think much more likely, when he says, thou art this head of gold, he does not mean Nebuchadnezzar personally, but means Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. And that could mean the period of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, these whole five kings together, or, I think still more likely, the whole period of the Assyrian and Babylonian empires. Now, that we discussed some time ago, but I wish you would review it because it is very important for the understanding of the prophecy. The next question was, discuss the meaning of Daniel 7:12. And someone came up to me and said, didn't you mean Daniel 7:13? Well, we discussed Daniel 7:13 at length. We spoke briefly about Daniel 7:12. And Daniel 7:12 says, well, we might look at the precise words of it. It is a verse which, if not carefully interpreted, could be rather baffling. Because after telling about the destruction of the great beast, it says, as for the rest of the beast, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. Does this mean that when the great beast, the fourth beast, was killed and his body burned, the other beasts continued on? That wouldn't make sense, would it? So it quite obviously is Daniel looking back in his vision and remembering the fact that the other beasts, when their dominion was taken away, they lived on. In other words, their qualities remained into the succeeding rule. So all four beasts make one continuous history of human sin and human wickedness ruling over the earth. A continuous thing, and all four are destroyed when the great beast is destroyed. That, of course, is clearly brought out in chapter 2, where it says that when the stone hit the statue, the gold, the silver, the bronze, the iron, and the clay were all mixed together and all dissolved and all blown away. And so that was a difficult point with this verse, the way it stands, and we took a little time to explain it. And I'm sorry that some of you did not remember it. Then number 4 was, briefly tell what is designated by the term Ancient of Days in each occurrence in Daniel 7. Of course, when I say in each occurrence, I meant that to mean that you show the difference between the occurrences. It is quite obvious that Ancient of Days means the one who has existed way, way back, the Ancient of Days. That, of course, is obvious. In the context, we learn that the Ancient of Days is one with tremendous power, 1,000 times greater, 1,000,000 times greater than any human being has ever had. But in this chapter, as we notice, this Ancient of Days is mentioned 3 times. And in the first occurrence, it is very obviously describing the triune God. Now, of course, someone may say, this is not the triune God, this is God the Father. I would not count that 100% wrong, but I certainly do not think that the Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit are so inferior to God the Father that a picture of God as the great, powerful one controlling the universe means only God the Father. And in the Old Testament, great stress is laid on the fact there is only one God, constantly stressed in the Old Testament, and certainly never denied in the New Testament. There is one God. And so it would seem to me that the Ancient of Days in verse 9 must be the triune God. I believe in the Old Testament, wherever it says God, it means the triune God, unless there's something in the context that clearly shows that it indicates one of the persons of the Godhead. And we find that this term Ancient of Days is used again where it says that one like a son of man had come to the Ancient of Days, been brought near before him, and been given dominion, glory, and a kingdom. And that very obviously refers to our Lord Jesus Christ. And so the Ancient of Days there cannot mean the triune God, must mean God the Father in this reference. And then the third reference is in verse 22, where it says that the little horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came. And that obviously is a reference to the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. And so that there, the Ancient of Days, is one person of the Godhead, the second person of the Godhead, the Lord Jesus Christ. So when I said in each occurrence, I was happy if you told about all three and very unhappy if you only made a general statement. And then number 5 was briefly mentioned various possibilities as to what is indicated in Daniel 2 by the stone and its effects. And we noticed various possibilities that might be mentioned. One of them was Islam, the Islamic Empire. One of them was the papacy. And then one, of course, is the idea that the Christian church is the stone that comes and gradually grows until it fills the whole earth. And another is that the stone that comes and hits the statue on its feet refers to the second coming of Christ, utterly destroying all the evil that is involved in human government and substituting a righteous government of the saints. There were those 4 various possibilities which could be briefly mentioned. But then I said, as far as time permits, discuss the 2 most probable. And as we noticed, the first 2 have been proven impossible by the fact that neither of them carried through. And so it is very obviously one of the last 2. And to my mind, it takes a good deal of twisting of the slate statements to represent the stone as being the Christian church. And, of course, it is very intriguing to suggest that the stone cut without hands represents the virgin birth, and if so, there's a long break between that and its hitting the image, because that happened in the very beginning time of the Roman Empire when the Christian church began. And no one can say humanly that it is impossible that the Christian church may so grow and so many people be converted that the whole world would be won to Christ and thus the kingdom of glory and happiness and peace established, but it certainly doesn't look that way, and there is no promise I know of in the Bible anywhere that such a thing is going to happen. And so it fits the imagery far better to say that it represents the coming of the Son of Man on the clouds of heaven, putting an end to all that was represented by the 4 beasts and establishing the kingdom of the saints. Mr. Montague, you had a question? Oh, yes. Yes, the Ancient of Days, the first one, is a mention of the great, glorious, triumphant God who's in control of all things. And that is certainly the triune God. not one person of the Godhead. How's that? Well, it's pretty hard to say. Some might say the fact that it says thrones and there's nobody else represented as sitting suggests the idea of Trinity, but I wouldn't want to build too much on that. But unless you do, it's pretty hard to explain why it does say thrones, because there's no mention there of anybody sitting. But certainly it is the triune God, whether you had one throne or three. It is figurative, of course. It's not a literal thing. And the second one shows the Son of Man brought before him and given authority. That must be Christ who sits on the right hand of God the Father. And the third one is the coming of the Ancient of Days to establish the kingdom on earth. That certainly must be the second person of the Trinity, Jesus Christ. Yes. Now, those were the questions given to the people with odd numbers. Now, with even numbers, the first was discuss the meaning and purpose of Daniel 7:4. And there were, in connection with Daniel 7:4, we discussed it here in class. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till its wings were plucked and it was lifted up from the earth. And you could say right away, well, here's the destruction of the Babylonian kingdom. Its wings are plucked and it's lifted up from the earth, the destruction of the Babylonian kingdom. But as we pointed out, there is nothing said about the destruction of any of the others of the first three. Nothing said about such a thing. So we won't take it as the destruction of the Babylonian kingdom unless we're sure. And we look further. And we find he was made lifted up from the earth and made stand on the feet as a man and a man's heart given to it. And that's no way to destroy something, to give it a man's heart, to give a beast a man's heart. But when we, as I pointed out, when we look back to the fourth chapter of Daniel, we find there the story of how Nebuchadnezzar was given a period of insanity in which he groveled on the earth like an animal and ate grass. And then God gave him his sanity back and he stood up again and God gave a man's heart to him and he had his kingdom back again. And so this, as we pointed out, would seem not to be a picture of the destruction of the Babylonian Empire, but a reference to an event that had occurred in the course of the history of the first kingdom, which Daniel had seen and been connected with. And knowing that, it would give him further assurance that the rest of the dream of the vision would also be carried out. Then the second question was, what pastime would best fit the description of the second phase of the fourth kingdom? Give reasons for and against. Now, if this was a course in history, and I asked you to discuss the history of the Roman Empire, and you gave me a very beautiful description of the Hellenistic Empire, I might say, well, you just misread the question. It's a good account of what you thought the question meant because you looked at it carelessly, and we won't take off for it. But this is a course in exegesis. And if you're going to exegete the Bible, you should be able to exegete a question on a test. And so, when I ask what pastime would fit the description of the second phase of the fourth kingdom, if I got an answer which mentioned the various interpretations of the meaning of the stone, why, I couldn't give any credit for that, naturally, because that's about as bad exegesis of a question as you could possibly make. We saw how chapter 2 had the static thing, the four parts of the kingdom, and then there's the second phase of the kingdom, and we saw how then occur the dynamic events, the coming of the stone. And so those who had the even-numbered question and gave an answer to question 5 of the odd-numbered questions could hardly get credit for that particular question. But the pastime that would best fit the description is very obviously, as I think I stated several times in class, the period from 400 to 600 A.D., when the Roman Empire was in a rapid decline, when there was a great mixture of Germanic peoples marching through the Roman Empire back and forth, pillaging, destroying, setting up kingdoms and then destroying each other's kingdoms. This would exactly fit a situation, except that it says there shall be in it some of the strength of the iron, and there was no strength in the Roman Empire that we can see in that 200-year period. And the statement, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, either could fit any time at all, or else must mean some very unusual thing. And if so, we don't know what it would be in connection with that. But most important against it, being that being the second phase of the fourth kingdom, is the fact that it specifically says that the stone strikes the image on its feet of iron and clay. And right at the end of that, the only things that could be said to be the stone would be the coming of Islam, which did not carry through. Or shortly afterwards, 2 or 3 centuries afterwards, the development of the power of the papacy, which also has not carried through. So that it would look as if what's meant by this second phase must be something still future. Now that was question 2. Question 3, briefly state whether the statue in Daniel 2 represents 4 kingdoms or 5, and give the reason for your answer. Yes, Mr. Martin?
You just, in question 2, overlapped with question 5 in your discussion, because you just mentioned that it would seem that the possibility was Islam arising, and also the papacy. Now, you were just dealing with question 2, and right at the conclusion of question 2, you said that the period from 400 to 600 was seen as maybe a part of, that would be one interpretation. Didn't you just say the rise of Islam and then faith? Now, could you distinguish between what you were representing as the interpretation for the stone and the interpretation for the second half of the Roman Empire?
Yes.
Because I think that was a little cloudy.
No, the second half of the Roman Empire, the second phase of it, rather, is a period described by the iron and the clay being mixed. And that could well fit the condition from 400 to 600 A.D. So that would be what the second phase would represent. The question wasn't about the stone, it was about the second phase. But then as to, I said, reasons for and against, the reasons for it, would be that it fits the description very well in general. The reason against it would be that it does not completely fit it, because there was no strength in the Roman Empire at that time. And because that peculiar phrase, mingling themselves with the seed of men, I don't know of anything you could say fulfilled it then that wouldn't have been present in all periods. But more importantly, because it was not followed by the coming of the stone. You see, we're discussing the second phase, what it is. We don't think it's then, because nothing came immediately after that could be the coming of the stone. In the other question, we were discussing what is the stone, and the question of when it comes enters to some extent.
Right, and still in our discussion, even a question came up later in the class, and you another class, beginning of the class period, you said how that why could it not be the continuation of the Roman papacy, the Roman church, through, and you presented that as another possibility.
But of course,
the second phase of the fourth kingdom.
Very good, very good. What I just referred to would be the simple answer to the question. But there are 2 additional things might have been said, were not required, but would have been good if said. One was this, that the critics say it fits the latter part of the time of the Seleucids, the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. And it would in many ways fit that. But of course, that's the third kingdom rather than the fourth. So that is not a satisfactory answer, but very good if you happen to think of it and mention it as a possibility, so long as you mention the main possibility, 400, 600. The other thing is that the second phase, if it isn't just 400 to 600, it's either something future, or you might say starts at 400 and reaches right on to the very end. Either way would be perfectly all right. Now the next question, number 3, briefly state whether the statue represents 4 kingdoms or 5. And as you look at chapter 2, you cannot tell whether it represents 4 kingdoms or 5. That is to say, there is a difference between the last two parts of chapter 2. So it could be 5 kingdoms. And yet they both have iron in, so it could be 4 kingdoms. So as far as chapter 2 is concerned, you couldn't tell whether it's 4 kingdoms or 5. But when you take chapter 7 into account, there you have only 4 beasts and not 5. And the fourth beast is destroyed, just as the fifth part of chapter 2 is destroyed. So it would be reasonable to say, in view of the parallel of the two, that it represents only 4 kingdoms and not 5. And then the fourth question for the even numbers was, in the time that remains, point out the relation of the known facts of history to the predictions of Daniel 2 and 7. Now, in relation to that, most of the facts that would be of help are on this sheet that I gave out. And I did not mean I want you to memorize all those dates or all the names on it. But the main features on it are contained. For instance, Alexander the Great founded the Hellenistic Empire. He had no connection with the Roman Empire, which came centuries later. But just the main facts of that, some did very well and some didn't at all. Now, of course, if you had ancient history in college, it should be easy to do well. If you didn't, it would be worth a little extra time looking at this sheet. And if that wasn't clear, perhaps looking at an encyclopedia or a history and getting a little clearer idea of it. Well, we'd better move on or we won't get finished with the prophecies this year. I think it would be better, I always say, it is better to have a thorough knowledge of Greek than to have a smattering of Greek and Hebrew both. I think that is absolutely certain. I hope you'll all know both well, but a smattering of both won't do anybody any good. Now here I would say, to get a good understanding of chapters 2 and 7 and know nothing about the rest of Daniel would be much more valuable than to have a slight smattering of 2, 7, 8, 9, and 11. And so I hope that those of you who had difficulty with some of these questions will review them and get it more thoroughly in mind. But we were discussing at our last meeting chapter 11. In chapter 11, we had noticed how it begins with the Persian attack on Greece. Greece is only named 3 times in Daniel and only once in the rest of the Old Testament. But here, Greece is specifically named in this 11th chapter. It mentions how Darius and Xerxes made a great attack on Greece in order to protect the parts of Asia Minor they had conquered. And then in verse 3, a mighty king rose up and ruled with great dominion, did according to his will. All agree that that is a reference to Alexander the Great. And then number 3, the dividing up of Alexander's empire. I have given you a statement last time, I believe, in mimeographed about the breakup of his empire and how it occurred, and a little bit about the subsequent history. We won't take time to go into that now, but I hope you have it in front of you, because we want to go on to look at capital C, the Seleucids and Ptolemies. And I'm not going to make subheads under them, because we will simply look at the verses. And so we find the beginning of the description of the Seleucids and the Ptolemies in verse 5, where it says, "The king of the south shall be strong," and no one need have any question what's meant by the king of the south. When you have a division of Alexander's empire, Egypt was much further south than anything else. And the general who took control of Egypt, whose name Ptolemy, was certainly one of the most powerful of the successors of Alexander. "So the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes." These prophetic statements all through this are quite clear when you look back at what happened. But very seldom could you tell in advance from them exactly what was going to happen. It's like many of the prophecies of Christ. It would be very hard to write a life of Christ simply from the Old Testament prophecies. But when the events occurred, you saw how exactly they fit with so many of those prophecies. And it was the assurance to you that this was indeed what the Lord had predicted. And so here, the statement that one of his princes will be strong and he shall be strong above him obviously doesn't mean that Ptolemy will be stronger than one of his princes. It must mean that this one of his princes will be stronger than he. And we know historically that Seleucid, after being working for Ptolemy for a time, saw his opportunity and went back to Babylon, where he had previously been in charge. And in 312 BC, he established himself in Babylon. And establishing himself there in 312, his successors continued to rule for centuries, and the date seemed so important that that's the first time in history that we know of that people have measured dates right along 1, 2, 3, 4 beyond one king's reign. In ancient Egypt, we read that in the 25th year of the reign of Ramesses II, something happened. Then we read in the 5th year of Merneptah, something happened. But we don't know how many years a date in Merneptah's reign would be after a date in his father's reign, unless we know how long his father lived. So we this very simple thing, it might seem to us, simply to number right along as we do year after year, never seems to have occurred to anybody in ancient times, and probably more or less by accident. Seleucus measured from the time when he went to Babylon, 312 BC, and when his son became king, instead of saying, in such a year of Antiochus, they continued the numbering right straight along. And that numbering was continued until, by some, as late as 1600 AD. It is the longest continued system of chronology that the world has ever seen. And some Hebrew manuscripts of the Bible are dated in the year, in the year 2612, would mean 2612 years after Seleucus went to Babylon in 312 BC. And the unfortunate thing is that sometimes they wouldn't bother to give the thousands, they'd just say 612, or they might just say the year 12. Because just like we sometimes just give the last two figures of the date. And so sometimes you know the exact year a Hebrew manuscript was written, but you don't know which century it was. But it starts in with 315 when Seleucus went to Babylon. So this was very exactly fulfilled. He shall be strong above him, stronger than Ptolemy, because he had the power. Ptolemy had Egypt. But Seleucus had all the territory reaching way over to India. Everything on the map there and further east. So he had a tremendous area that he held, as large as all the rest of Alexander's empire put together, was the area which Seleucus held. So this statement, he shall be strong above him, was very remarkably fulfilled. And his dominion shall be a great dominion. And then verse 6 jumps forward. There is an unmentioned interval between verse 5 and verse 6. And I hope you all have the little chart before you. Look at the left side of the chart where I have the kings listed. And it shows how Ptolemy first died in 283. Seleucus first died in 281, just 2 years later. But Ptolemy's second reign, during the last part of Seleucus' reign, during all of Antiochus' first reign, and during most of Antiochus' second reign. And we find here the statement, at the end of years. Does that mean the end of the world? The end of years? There are people who would interpret such a phrase that way sometimes. But certainly doesn't mean that here. Because here it means after a while, after quite a while, because it skips ahead from Seleucus who went to Babylon in 312, clear down to the latter part of the reign of his grandson, Antiochus II. Now, you couldn't tell that from the prediction, but we know that what happened fits with what is stated here. At the end of years, they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. And there was clashing between these two, each of them wanting to get a little more of the territory the other had, off and on. But the time came when Seleucus' grandson, Antiochus II, and the now very elderly Ptolemy II, who is known as Ptolemy Philadelphus, decided not to keep fighting, but a little skirmishing between them, but to make a friendly alliance. And so they came together. And the king's daughter of the south, Ptolemy II's daughter, came to the king of the north to make an agreement. And we find that Antiochus II agreed that in order to cement this alliance, he would marry the daughter, Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy II. Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy II, came up there to marry him, and verse goes on to say, but she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begot her, and he that strengthened her in these times. You'd never know what that means is going to happen. But as you look back and you find that when she came up there, that she married the king, and he already had a wife, and his wife had grown sons, and she didn't like it a bit that he married this daughter of the king of Egypt. And so she left Antioch here where he was living, and she went up into Asia Minor, which also belonged to him. And she lived up there in Asia Minor with her grown son. And the Antiochus was down there in Asia Minor. And Antiochus was with Bernice. And Bernice had a child. And Laodice, his first wife, was afraid that he would make the child of the second wife king after him. And so she did not like that at all, and the great many of the people of the empire felt that she had been mistreated. And the result was that after a while, he got tired of Bernice, and he went up there to Asia Minor with her. But then she was still afraid that he might make his child by the daughter of the king of Egypt king, and so it was generally believed that she poisoned him. At any rate, he died. And when he died, she managed to have some of her people get a hold of Bernice and kill her, and also kill her child. And so we read here that she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begot her. And that means her father died at about this time. And so, verse 7 says, out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate. And what would be a branch of her roots? Well, her roots would be her father, King Ptolemy. And a branch of her roots would be her brother, Ptolemy III. And so Ptolemy III came with an army and attacked the king of the north and prevailed. And verse 8, and also carried captives into Egypt, their gods, their princes, their precious vessels of silver and gold, and continued more years than the king of the north. And so it looked as if the Seleucus was losing out in this, which had been intended to make friendship between them. It produced enmity. And you never could have told what's going to happen. But looking back, you can see how exactly it fit. And then verse 9, so the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. Most interpreters consider that to mean that he shall come into the kingdom of the king of the south. That if you take it, the Hebrew could be translated either way. You take it the way it stands, it could be simply a recapitulation of verses 7 and 8. Brother Bernice, yes, says Bernice is the daughter of Ptolemy II. He was her brother. And so, verse 9 is generally taken as meaning an attempt of the Seleucids to attack Egypt again, which failed. There was one which failed, but it could be simply a summary of the previous verse. So either translation would fit with facts there. But verse 10, his son shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through and return and be stirred up even to his fortress. And it continues with the attempt of the King Ptolemy to get vengeance, and the fact that eventually there came a king of the north who was very strong. You have on your list Seleucus III here, who reigned for only 4 years. One of the sons of Laodice. He reigned for only 4 years when there was a rebellion in the army and he was killed, and his brother Antiochus III became king. And Antiochus III is called the Great because he would have been one of the greatest figures in ancient history, not one of the top ones, but the very second rank, if it were not for an unfortunate thing that happened at the end of his reign. This Antiochus III, who is called the Great, is described here in the course of verse 13 right on up to verse 19. We have a long description here of the reign of one of the most powerful conquerors in ancient history, but largely forgotten because of the failure at the end of his reign. Now, it describes here how the king of the north comes in verse 13 with a great army and with much riches, and he attacks the king of the south. Now, at this point, we need to remind ourselves of the situation there between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. The Ptolemies held Egypt, but they also held Palestine and southern Syria. They held that for 100 years. And the Seleucids had been trying to get possession of that part of Asia there, to get it away from the Ptolemies. And Antiochus III succeeded in doing so. And when he did so, this is of great interest to the Hebrews, because Palestine was very prosperous under the Ptolemies and was getting along well under them, but there were some who were dissatisfied. There were some Israelites who were unhappy, and they tried to get their area freed from Ptolemy, which would bring them under the Seleucids. And if they did that, they thought that would give them more freedom. And actually, it led to the terrible crisis that is described in this chapter under Antiochus IV. And so we read here that verse 14, in those days there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Well, now Antiochus III was making a series of campaigns against the Ptolemies, and this many suggests people helping him. It is generally thought that this refers to the time when the king of Macedonia, for a brief period, joined with him against the Ptolemies. I think, though, it could equally well refer to many in Israel, thinking they would be better off under the Seleucids than under the Ptolemies, who joined with him. You cannot say which, because it merely says many. But the next phrase says, the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. Now, what does that mean? The robbers of thy people. Speaking thy people, certainly speaking about Israelites. And this is considered by all interpreters, I believe, to mean that there were Jews who revolted against Ptolemy, thinking they'd be better off under the Seleucids, under Antiochus III. And so they had a vision, they had an idea they'd be much better off under the Seleucids, freedom from the Ptolemies. But they shall fall. Actually, they were much worse off, as we find out in the latter part of the chapter. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a siege mound and take the fortified cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be strength to withstand. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. So that from this time on, Palestine, or Israel, and southern Syria are joined with the rest of the Seleucid territory and taken away from the Ptolemies. And then verse 17 says, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. And Antiochus III gave his daughter Cleopatra in marriage to the son of Ptolemy IV, thinking that that would cement friendship between the two countries. But actually, Cleopatra, but this is the first Egyptian woman to be known as Cleopatra, which formerly had been a name among the Seleucids. This daughter of Antiochus III threw her whole influence with her husband and against her father. And so that did not work out. Well, for today, you looked at verses 21 on, which deal with the Antiochus IV. If we hadn't had to take time to review the test, I would have gotten over that today. But we'll plan to do that next time. So I guess we'll stop at this point.